I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, it's good to be with you again.
A few weeks ago, you told us how to set about risk-proofing your investments, and that related to things you could do before you acquire the property. So today, I thought it would be helpful if you were to explore things you could do to protect your properties once you own them.
Well, when it comes to protecting your assets, the first thing you need to do is take this seriously and understand why it is that you actually need protection. And we're not just talking about insurance here. And then you need to consider the best ways of achieving the level of security and protection that you need, which can more often than not involve just some simple common sense strategies. The thing is, nowadays society is becoming more and more litigious. And therefore, as I've probably said in earlier podcasts, getting the right advice on the appropriate purchase vehicle is really vital. It's paramount, you know, you just got to get that. And I think in last week's podcast, I talked about the reasons for having the first 10 minutes with the tax guy in HWL Ebsworth's office. Now, yes, it's to do with planning and tax reasons and so forth, but it's equally to make sure that you have your assets protected from financiers making claims, protected from aggrieved parties who have an involvement with your property, maybe even family members. So there's a whole lot of levels of protection that you need to consider. And as I said, the one that most people focus on is just insurance, and the physical insurance of the property. But it goes a lot deeper than that. And this is what you really need to understand.
So let's talk in more detail about the need to take asset protection seriously.
There are probably a couple of reasons why people tend to overlook the need for protection, as I've said, other than insurance. You see, initially when you start out, it may be just one property, it may not be a very large property, and at that point you don't necessarily see the need for asset protection in the wider sense of the word. Now, the next step is you start to build a portfolio and you become busy, or you simply really don't know what it is you should be doing. And so you just don't seek out the advice. And you have to understand and acknowledge that people die, they get divorced, they get remarried. All these sort of events more often than not involve the tax office in some shape or form. However, just so long as you get the advice at the outset, you can anticipate and accommodate these events, even though they may never happen. As I say to clients, it's not a problem until it's a problem, and then it's a bloody big problem. So you just got to, at the time, and the time is at the beginning, not when you bought a couple of properties and then you got to unwind things. It becomes very complicated, legally involved. There's stamp duty issues if you're having to transfer a property from one name to another. So it's far better to try and map out for the next 10, 15, even 20 years, longer maybe, a plan and take the best steps you can today to give you the most protection that you can going forward. And, you know, it's what lawyers call the legal protection, tax planning, estate planning. I mean, it involves all of that. And the important thing is also that, you know, if you do get sued, the last thing you want to do is to lose everything or have it affect the family home. I mean, as I said, it's not overly complicated doing it early, but it can become terribly complicated if you've got to unwind things and rearrange assets down the track, which may well be 10, 15 years down the track. So A little bit of thought and planning and advice at the early stage will stand you in good stead going forward.
You mentioned a moment ago that there were some common sense strategies investors should employ. What might some of those be?
Yes, there are a number of simple things that you can do to help ensure that particularly you never get sued. And the first of these is to make sure that all your dealings are ethical and professional. Now, that's not being preachy. We're just talking about doing everything above board. So your conduct cannot be questioned. And that involves every aspect, really, from the purchase right through to when you sell, so that you don't try and cut corners, you don't take any unnecessary risks in your dealings with people, and you're always upfront and straightforward. The second one is that you need to always maintain your properties in tip-top condition. Now, I know part of the training I say that at the end of the first 12 months of your ownership, you should make sure from that point onwards that you have your property in ready-to-sell condition. Now, even if the tenant is required under the lease to look after the property and maintain it, you need to ensure that the property is fairly regularly inspected. And with commercial property, you have essential services inspections, and generally they're 6 monthly, and you get a report or a shopping list of things that need to be done. So more often than not, that will pick up things, certainly of the compliance nature, but it'll talk about, you know, doors that don't close properly and security lighting and things like that. So they're all aspects that need to be attended to, and with a good managing agent, that's not a problem. But equally, you, for safety reasons, you want to make sure that that is done. And as you progressively build up your portfolio, one of the things you don't want to do is have an unseemly display of your prosperity and your wealth, because that only invites lawsuits from aggrieved parties. But one of the key aspects of insurance and the lease with a tenant will require the tenant to take out public risk insurance. But equally, you as a landlord, as part of the building insurance, you need to take out public risk insurance as well. Because sometimes there can be a grey area. If someone slipped on the step into the property, well, the tenant will, insurance company may argue, well, it's not actually in the tenancy, therefore we're not going to meet the claim. So therefore they say, well, the next person's the landlord. So it's always best to be over covered. And public risk insurance is not that expensive. I think it's $200 or $300 premium a year for about $20 million cover. Now, again, your premium will be picked up under the lease by the tenant anyway, but the important thing is that you make sure that the public risk is covered and then recoup that, or have your managing agent recoup that from the tenant. Thirdly, always record your encounters with people, whether it is directly with the tenant or with the tenant through your managing agent. I mean, sometimes all it needs is a short diary note, maybe quick confirming email. If it's something major, you probably ought to do a formal letter if you're confirming some sort of agreement that you've reached, maybe to do with a lease documentation or whatever. Now, you still may email the letter to whoever is involved, but you've set it out formally so that it's a document that can be printed out if and when required. Now, all I can say is that in my 45 years or so in property, acting for clients, whoever has the most detailed and comprehensive file will win. And that's if we're talking about if things end up going to court. When I say court, it may be the legal court, or it may be the VCAT in Victoria, just, you know, for the Administrative Tenancy Tribunal. So, but what I'm saying is that if you have things noted down methodically so that you are covered and have each aspect that when issues arise and they're dealt with carefully documented. So I said sometimes all it needs is a diary note. It doesn't have to be, if it's a minor point, you can just note it down in your diary. But if it gets anything more major than that, you escalate it up either to an email or to a formal letter. So that's just covering off. Again, you may never need them, but if you do need them, you need to be able to grab them quickly, print them out, and collate a file that stands you in good stead when you get into any legal stoushes that may occur down the track. But all of this fundamentally hangs on what we discussed earlier, and that is the choosing of the correct purchase vehicle, and more importantly, having a separate vehicle for each property. And that means that if the entity is ever sued, the outcome will only affect that property alone. So any issues that arise, whether it's a loan falling over or someone suing you, is all quarantined to that particular unit. So the worst thing can happen is that you lose that property, not the other properties, not your home, so that, again, it's just common sense. You just quarantine everything to where the issue is and either resolve it or, as I said, it may require liquidating that particular entity, and I'm not looking for problems here. I'm just saying you've got to look at the worst situation. If you quarantine it and keep it just to that one property, then you don't have concerns about where you're going to live or is someone going to make a claim against your home. So I think those are probably the main areas that you need to focus on.
That would seem to cover the legal side of things. What else should investors consider when it comes to protecting their assets?
Now, I've talked a lot about using separate entities for each acquisition, and that so you can, as I said, quarantine any adverse effects to just the one property. However, if you, in your borrowing arrangements, provide a personal guarantee for any loans you take out, then allows the lender to go after you personally and your personal assets to meet any shortfall. And if you think about it, that more or less defeats the purpose of having a separate entity. So in this situation, you've got a couple of options. The first one is that you make sure that you hold no other assets in your own name. I'm talking about the home or whatever it is. So the worst thing that can happen to you then is if they come at you as the personal guarantor, is that you end up being declared bankrupt, but your other assets, which are in separate entities or separate names, will therefore be protected and remain intact. Now, no one wants to go bankrupt, but it's a hell of a lot better than having to sell up all the other assets. Now, the only other alternative is to not go for the max in borrowing with commercial property, which is 70%, is to only take out what's called a non-recourse loan, which is around about 65% or less, so that the property in question becomes the sole security for that loan. Now, I know we've discussed it in the past, and you know sometimes you've just got to lower your sights a little bit. Yeah, it's good to borrow more because you've got less equity involved and your return on your equity will be greater, but you've got to balance that off with the potential risks. And, you know, there's risks and just the ability to sleep at night. Some people feel, you know, more comfortable knowing that it is a non-recourse loan. I mean, some people only borrow 30, 40, 50%. I mean, that's their comfort level. But what I'm saying to you is that for maximum protection, you should make your maximum borrowing 65% and always go for non-recourse loans, which means that it's only the property that's offered as security, not your personal guarantee.
Any final comments you'd like to make?
Well, perhaps the only thing we haven't talked about is insurance, which is really what most people think when we talk about protecting your assets. Now, insurance covers a lot of things, obviously the building, but the important thing is when you're taking out insurance, you should take out insurance that includes removal of debris, consultants fees, loss of rent, machinery breakdown, and so forth. And it's interesting, I recently put together an in-depth session on insurance for my mentor group, and it's a recording that runs for about 10 and a half minutes, and it's a video. And if you like, what I'll do is I'll give you a link to include beneath this podcast if our listeners would like to discover more about the ins and outs of making sure that your insurance covers everything that it should, and to offer you the greatest protection possible, because it's a vexed question, very complex. Not a lot of people understand it. Most people think all they've got to do is ring up their broker and take out a cover note. But unless you get the right insurance cover, you might find if you do have a fire or some damage to the property that you will not get back exactly what you think you should receive back. Notwithstanding you've been paying all your premiums, if you've got the wrong insurance, it just doesn't provide you with the cover that you really anticipated it would. So, as I said, I'll give you that link if they'd like to explore that a little bit further.
I think doing that would be very helpful, Chris. And all they need to do is to log on to propertybriefings.com, where episode 116 should be at the top of the list. Anyway, now we're producing these podcasts on a monthly basis, and therefore have a little more time, I wonder if you'd like to talk about something you've mentioned on several occasions, and that is changing the use of a commercial property. How do you actually go about doing this?
Well, there's probably a couple of ways that you can go about this. If you've got an older industrial property and some of the inner city zonings now have a mixed use zoning, and that means that it has a wide range of permitted uses, from industrial to offices, and some of it service retail being things like cafes and restaurants and so forth. And that means that within that current zoning, you have a number of what are loosely termed as-of-right uses. In other words, you can make that change. Sure, you've got to comply with the building code, but from a town planning point of view, you don't need to apply for any permission. Generally, the planning scheme is various columns and it lists uses as-of-right, and then the alternative is that within that zoning, you can have what are called permitted uses. In other words, you actually have to apply for a town planning permit or make an application for a town planning permit, because some of those uses are stretching the envelope a little bit within that zoning. Now, generally, there are conditions. In other words, if you provide a certain number of car parks, then you can have it. But again, you have to demonstrate with a set of plans for a planning permit as opposed to a building permit that you are meeting those requirements. So those are the basic ones. And then alternatively, you instead of just converting an existing building, you can demolish it and start again and come up with some completely different use and configuration of the site, which may well be more efficient. You might have an extra couple of levels on it, which would be difficult to achieve with the existing building if it's only, say, a single story. So you do have a couple of options there.
So what you're saying is that sometimes you can make the change as of right, but other times it may require a change of zoning or require a planning permit. Are there any issues you need to consider if you choose to go down that path?
Well, if you seek to go down the path of a planning permit or a change of zoning, well, the things you need to be aware of are time delays. And they can occur in one of two ways. In other words, through the council. In other words, sometimes, well, obviously the council only meets at its regular times each month, and you have to go through the town planning department. They have to prepare their submission to the council officers, and then they, after approval, if it does go through with the council, then it comes back again to the town planning department and they issue the ultimate permit with or without conditions. Now, part of that process may well be for the council or councillors to invite objections to the change of use that's taking place. Now, if that happens, and generally the objections have to be meaningful objections. They can't be what's called vexatious objections just for the sake of complaining. There has to be some logical objection at law with the permit that you're seeking to achieve to bring about the change of use that you're planning. Now, if there are objections, then you end up going to, in the case of Victoria, it's called VCAT, which is not a court, but it's a tribunal to keep the costs down and hopefully speed things up. And generally they encourage you to try and mediate the matter beforehand. But once that decision is made, there is no appeal to it. Now, some of the other issues that the council may come back, and as a result of your town planning application, there may be also delays when you come and apply for your building permit, and that they can relate to essential services requirements and things like disabled access, because, and particularly with older buildings. Now, generally, if it's a new building, you have to comply with the latest laws. If it's an existing building, generally the rule of thumb is if you're not altering more than 50% of the building, then you can get an exemption and don't necessarily have to comply with the very latest regulations. So these are the sort of things that you'll take into account, because they can impact on things like cost and time going forward. So they're just, you've got to be aware of them. And that's why it's important to get a good consulting team in place who can advise you of the potential of these sort of problems going forward. Now, if you get good team in place, and particularly a good building surveyor, then he can anticipate and provide you with workarounds. Now, particularly when you're talking about a building permit, the councils traditionally have and can still issue building permits, but now the law in most states is that you can have an independent third party outside of the council issue a building permit, not a town planning permit, but a building permit. Now, when you're applying for your town planning permit, it's quite often a good idea to get that your ultimate team, when the construction or refurbishment takes place, involved early, because the building surveyor can alert you to things that if you do this, then you will have to comply, and that's going to cost you additional money. However, if you take this alternate route, we can provide a workaround or a dispensation to compliance with the very latest in building regulations. So, as I said, those are, in essence, the main issues that you need to consider.
Therefore, what would your advice be to investors who need to go down the planning route to bring about a change of use?
Well, as I normally say, it's not overly complicated. You just need common sense. And the thing you need to do is plan ahead. And if you've got your team involved, you can build in the time delays, because time delays cost money. And, you know, if the property is vacant, and that's what you've got to make sure, you've got a sufficient cash flow to cover any extended periods of vacancy, because while it's sitting there, it's not earning income, and therefore it's a cost, in as much as I presume you've got the property mortgage, therefore there is an interest bill ticking over which you have to cover. And also then you've got a construction period, and if that gets extended, because it may well be that you've got to be careful that you want to apply for your town planning permits while the tenant is still in place. So that's why I talk about planning ahead, so that you want to make sure you've got your town planning permit and your building permits already in hand well before the tenancy is due to expire. And it may well be that the existing tenant agrees to continue on after you do the work. If it's a pretty easy refurb, sometimes they might move out if it's a longer one and then move back in again. But the last thing you want to be doing is have the property sitting there eating its head off while you're still applying and obtaining your town planning and building permits. So, as I said, the time to do all this prep work is while the property is still earning income. So literally the day the tenant leaves in the following week is when the construction crowd move in and start work, because that's the biggest issue, I think, that you face as an investor, because you've got to just shorten that time frame from getting possession to getting the new tenant in and paying rent. So I guess that's what I'm... It's not... If you're just starting out as an investor, this is not what you do as your first project. You want to have at least two or three, I would say more like four or five properties, and then your fifth or sixth one might be one where you tackle something a little bit more adventurous of refurbing or changing the use. So it's, as I said, it's basically common sense.
I guess this is not something every investor will embark upon, but nonetheless, it has been useful for our listeners in rounding out their understanding.
Yeah, look, I think the important thing is to have several properties already in your portfolio, and that gives you the confidence to cope with the property you have and working on being vacant during the process of adding considerable value to it.
Thanks, Chris. And look, I look forward to catching up next week.